This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Back in December, I got the honor of going out on one of the only commercial fishing boats in New England actually trying to catch cod. Cod fishing, of course, has been essentially banned in the wake of a report released last summer showing that the number of reproductively active cod in the Gulf of Maine is at just 3-4% of what would be needed for a healthy, sustainable population. Here's the twist. The boat I was on, the Barbara K. Peters, was catching cod not for food, but for research. A graduate student from UMass Dartmouth School of Marine Science and Technology spent a very long, cold day inserting radio tags into the bellies of cod so that their location can be tracked over time. The goal of the project is to pin down exactly when and where cod, at least the few that are left, gather to make more cod. Fishermen and scientists have long known that cod form are what known as spawning aggregations, and fishery managers have put rather large areas off limits for up to months at a time to protect those gatherings. The hope with this research is that closures could be targeted more precisely to allow fishermen as much access as possible without threatening the fish. Joining me in our Woodtoll studio to talk more about this project, Chris McGuire, Marine Program Director for the Nature Conservancy, Micah Dean, Environmental Analyst with the Department of Marine Fisheries, and Sophie Van Paris, who leads the Passive Acoustics Group at the Northeast Fisheries Science Center. Welcome to all of you.
Thanks, Heather.
Thank you.
Micah, your job at the Department of Marine Fisheries is to monitor and conduct research on cod spawning. The project we're talking about today obviously falls into that. Given the dire situation with the cod population as a whole, I have to ask, how relevant is this kind of research at all if we're looking at a population that may be crashing completely?
Well, there's understanding where and when cod spawn, I think, is critically important to the future of the Gulf of Maine cod stock. As you may know, there's lots of genetically distinct populations of cod within a stock, and these have strong fidelity to their specific spawning locations, which means they'll return to the same location year after year. And if you exploit one of these groups beyond its capacity to sustain itself, it can cease to exist, and you'll lose that evolutionary knowledge to spawn at an optimal time and location. So we're trying to fill this void of information about the when and the where and the how of cod spawning so that we can design conservation measures to prevent any loss of additional groups.
Chris McGuire, the funding for this particular project comes from a grant, a Saltonstall Kennedy grant. Tell us a little bit about this program and why this is special.
Well, just to back up a little, when this program was first proposed by the commercial fishermen we're working with on the South Shore, we recognized that it was important to try and get to work right away. And so one of the reasons, one of the roles that the Nature Conservancy plays is we helped, along with the Division of Marine Fisheries, to fund the first year of this project because it just takes a long time to apply for and be awarded federal grant funding. We were successful with our research team here in getting that grant funding through the Saltonstall Kennedy program. The funds for that come from a tax on imported seafood, and that tax has been in place for a long time. And the idea behind these projects is to basically, increase yield and increase fishing opportunities for fishermen in the U.S. And so one of the things that that we targeted in this grant application was basically saying the best way to have fishermen be more successful is for there to be more fish. And our project is designed to, as Micah said, to help identify in order to protect these important spawning aggregations. And to your earlier question about why do this if the stock is at such a low level, I think it's important to see that in other fish stocks, fish are incredibly fecund. You know, that means that they have a lot of eggs at a time, and there have been enormous comebacks for other fish species from relatively low levels. And they've happened here in New England and other places around the world. So I don't think all hope is lost just because we're at a low level right now.
Now, you said that the idea for this project actually came from the fishermen. How common is that to have fishermen coming to you saying, you know, here's a question that we really need answered. Can you work with us to figure this out?
I think that's what really drew me to this project in the first place, is that I hadn't had experience with that. And I was so refreshing to see that the fishermen from this one port and in the Gulf of Maine had this longer perspective that it was in their best interest to try to preserve this interest in the bank account so that they can generate future fish to be able to be caught by the fishery. And so I don't know of other examples where it's the fishermen have brought this to us to say, please help us identify a group of fish that we see disappearing too fast. Help us identify it so that it can be conserved.
Sophie, how much direct contact have you had with the fishermen in this project, and how different does that make the research feel to have the fishermen who will be, you know, the people most impacted in some ways by the research in the end actually be involved in the genesis of the project and conducting the research?
It's been pretty incredible. It's not something I'm used to at all. We, you know, focus on listening to marine animal sounds, and most of our work is really looking at marine mammals and where they are and where they go. So fish in itself and fish acoustics was a new thing to me, but then to be brought into this project where the actual can see the reality of the situation and to have fishermen directly involved in explaining and asking for advice and help, really, in terms of research and better informed research was really inspiring.
Refreshing.
Yes.
In case you're just joining us, I'm talking with Micah Dean, Sophie Van Paris, and Chris McGuire about their research to understand when and where cod go to reproduce. As we were just mentioning, the project directly involves fishermen, and I want to bring in the voice of one of them, Frank Morarchi. Frank is 71, a lifelong fisherman based out of Scituate, and this is not his first foray into research. In fact, he had the boat we were out on, the Barbara K. Peters, built specifically for the dual purposes of fishing and research. So as we steamed away from the dock, I asked him how it was that he first got involved in research.
Out of desperation. We couldn't make any money fishing back in the early 1990s. And I had another boat at the time, the Christopher Andrew, which we kind of retrofitted. And, you know, the research became a significant part of our business. So when we built this boat, we built it with the dual capabilities of fishing and research.
So how different? What are some of the modifications you had to make to be able to do research?
The big deck, big open deck, the crane that we just loaded our supplies with was very helpful. Big generator, a 50-kilowatt generator that can support a lot of equipment if they need to bring it. That's primarily it. You know, it's a balance between fishing and research, and that was the research contribution.
You said it's a significant part of your business. I mean, how much money can you bring in on the research?
Well,
maybe if you were to compare, you know, a day of research to a day of fishing.
I don't anymore. There is no more research because the funding is pretty much dried up. You know, with the exception of this project, this is all that's going on presently. The research really ended shortly after this boat was built, you know, with the demise of congressional earmarks, and it's just been scratched ever since. So, you know, a project here and there. I had a business relationship with a company down on the Cape called CR Environmental, and you know, we haven't done any work together in probably 5 or 6 years now. Whenever there's a crisis, some more money shows up, like the Salt and Saul Kennedy money, but it's not reliable anymore, and it's not a significant source of revenue anymore.
When you first started working with scientists, well, first of all, how did you start working with scientists? How did you first get involved in the research?
We first got involved back in the early 80s with a couple of researchers that worked for the Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries that were doing what's called conservation engineering work, you know, designing more efficient nets and more selective nets. And that was kind of fun. You know, it wasn't a revenue source by any stretch. And it was very interesting, and we learned quite a bit about fish behavior and how to rig nets and all. And then it just kind of grew from there to maybe we can make some money at this, and you know, maybe we can actually contribute to management with the work that we do. And it grew from kind of playing around with handheld cameras to putting video cameras with direct cable connection to the surface and real-time readouts in the nets and designing nets. And then it bled over into these other things like environmental monitoring and habitat mapping and things of that sort as well.
Was your primary motivation getting into the research the money?
No, actually it wasn't at all. The primary motivation at the beginning was, it was interesting. It piqued my interest. And I thought we could make fishing more efficient, more effective, and more conservation-oriented than it used to be. I mean, it used to be we'd put a huge pile of fish on deck and paw through and pick out the ones we could keep or the ones we wanted to keep and throw the rest overboard. And, you know, it never seemed like a really smart way to run the business. So we tried at the very beginning just to be able to minimize the amount of discards that we had and maximize the value of what came aboard the boat.
How did fellow fishermen respond when you started working with researchers? I mean, those relationships are not always the friendliest.
No, I would say not in situate. No, everybody was very, as a matter of fact, you know, a lot of the projects we had multiple boats working on. There's always skepticism, you know, when the project involves something that may end up with a negative impact on management. But for the most part, the impacts were positive, and the results were favorable to fishing and fishermen, and the reception amongst the fellow fishermen was good, you know, plus they got work out of it, too. That was part of the whole concept, was that the Scituate Fleet would be a place that you could go if you wanted some research work done, and you'd find numerous fishermen that had different skill sets and different gear types that could contribute to the project.
Do you think you've seen the relationship between scientists and fishermen change since you started working with scientists? Has it become more hostile, more tense?
It depends on who the scientists are, really. Certainly, you know, in terms of right now, the stock assessment issue is very tense, and there's a lot of disagreement. But in terms of defining stock areas and developing, again, you know, conservation engineering type work, I don't think there's a lot of tension at all. I think there's a very collegial atmosphere still.
Where do you find yourself falling on some of the debates about the stock assessment science?
I'm skeptical. I'm really kind of upset that fishermen have been excluded from data collection. You know, there used to be an industry-based survey. I was not part of that, so I didn't lose anything when it ended. But it ended because of funding. You know, as I mentioned, the earmarks, the congressional earmarks, were contributed to the demise of the IBS. Since then, there's been absolutely nothing. You know, the only eyes that science sees, the only insight to the fishery is the government surveys. You know, the state of Massachusetts, the states of Maine and New Hampshire have a survey, and then the federal survey using the Henry Bigelow. And it's I'm just skeptical that those snapshots that they take are adequate to really define what's going on in the ocean. It seems like the rate of change in the ocean is increasing, and the amount of observation of those changes is diminishing at the same time. I don't think it's a very comfortable place to be.
So your work with scientists hasn't maybe made you trust the other science that's going on anymore, you don't think?
Well, I mean, science is not a religion. Science is a methodology. And if you cheap out on the methodology because you don't have enough money to do all you want to do, then, you know, you have to be skeptical. I don't think there's anybody that, even the people that are at the Science Center, that would not like to see more information, but they can't afford it. So they take what they can get, and I don't think what they get is adequate to describe what's going on, and particularly the Gulf of Maine, but probably elsewhere as well, you know, with the rapid changes in environment and predator-prey relationships and whatever else is happening that we don't fully understand.
Am I correct? You're actually looking to sell this boat? Are you looking to get out of fisheries at this point?
Well, I'm kind of retiring. I'm 71. And this boat was built as a partnership with my son, and he just decided the business part of fishing was just too unstable. They have a young child at home. So he's not working on the boat anymore, and it's just too much for me. You know, it's too big, and my knees are shot, basically.
Are you disappointed that your son won't be fishing?
Well, yeah, but I don't think he won't be fishing forever, to be honest with you. I really still think we can fix this fishery, and that we desperately need young people in this business. I mean, this is one of the things that really worries me now, is that we're seeing a demographic shift that I've never seen before. You know, there's no young fishermen anymore. Well, there's not many. There's a few, but they're few and far between. And that really, really worries me, because I see basically a hyper-consolidation away from small ports, away from small boats, and towards corporate, large port, large boat type of structures that I don't think are, they're not what I'd like to see. You know, they're worth, they'll take fish from the ocean and put them in the marketplace and food on people's tables, but it won't be the same as what I saw when I grew up.
Do you really think the cod fishery can bounce back at this point?
I don't know.
Are you optimistic?
No, I'm not. First of all, I don't think it's healthy to have a fishery that's called a cod fishery, because when I was growing up, there never was a cod fishery. There was a groundfish fishery that included cod as part of a suite of species of fish that we caught. You know, and some years were good cod years and some years were not. Nobody really paid much attention. They just went fishing, and what they caught was what they caught. So it's been kind of rebranded as a cod fishery in the last decade or so, and it actually did become a cod fishery during the early 2000s when there was a huge explosion in abundance of fish. And we were under days at sea where we were just rushing out and getting 800 pounds of cod and rushing back in again. That, I guess, was a cod fishery, but that's not the norm. So I don't think that's going to bounce back, no.
That was fisherman Frank Murarchi of Scituate. Frank is obviously kind of a wise old elder. I mean, he's a guy with a lifetime of experience in the fishery, curious, a healthy dose of skepticism, intelligent, articulate. I mean, how much insight do you get from working with a guy like that when you go out and try to understand these cod populations that he's been fishing his entire life?
Oh, as you can sense from your conversation with him, he's just an incredibly deep well of information. And his longevity in the fishery gives us this perspective that we wouldn't otherwise have. And part of what we were trying to do in this project is grow from the studies that we have done earlier on spawning aggregations elsewhere in the Massachusetts coast and try to apply the similar methodology off of the Port of Scituate, where these fishermen had approached us to try to conduct this work. And we didn't have the local knowledge about where the fishery saw groups of spawning fish occurring. And Frank was invaluable in steering us in that direction with the network of fishermen that he interacts with as well. It was a great atmosphere to be able to start a project where you had so much more to go on to initiate something than just the typical course data sets that you would get from trawl surveys.
Yeah, it's interesting. Micah and his team did a really good job of looking at all the research data that was out there and identifying, you know, where we should be looking for spawning cod. And at the same time, we met with a number of fishermen, including Frank, and had them sort of draw circles on the chart. And at least our first year of information that we've collected, it makes it look like Frank's circles were pretty darn good, which is probably not surprising to anyone.
That's Chris McGuire, also in the studio with me, Micah Dean and Sophie Van Paris. We'll talk more about their efforts to understand cod reproduction in New England's waters when Living Lab continues after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guests today are Sophie Van Paris from the Northeast Fisheries Science Center, Micah Dean with the Massachusetts Department of Marine Fisheries, and Chris McGuire from the Nature Conservancy. Together, they are finding ways to listen in on the private lives of New England's most iconic fish, the cod. If that doesn't sound sexy to you, please stick around for a few minutes so that we can change your mind. Micah Dean, before the break, you were talking about, and Chris also, kind of how this project got started and how little we knew and going to fishermen to figure out what they knew about where cod go to reproduce. Why don't we already know this? We've been fishing for cod for 400 years in New England. Why don't we know when and where they go to reproduce?
Well, think about the primary way that we as scientists and fishermen observe where and when cod are and what condition they might be in, whether they're spawning or not. And that's typically from trawls, from other fishing gears like gill nets or long lines. But a trawl can be miles long in its course of collecting the fish that it dumps on the deck of a boat. The scale at which these reproductive behaviors are occurring are typically far smaller. The area that we know the most about that is a little bit further north from Scituate off of the Port of Gloucester, the entire aggregation occurs inside of an area about the size of a football field. So the methodology that we've been employing here through acoustic telemetry, where we insert these tags into fish and a series of receivers out there to detect where they are and locate them, gives you that finer scale view of where specifically these spawning aggregations are occurring and what sort of behaviors they're undertaking.
Chris McGuire, you have a great analogy for what we do at least understand about how spawning aggregations work, where the male fish are, where the female fish are, and you kind of compare it to a nightclub scene. So explain that.
Yeah, well, just in working on this project, I learned from Micah and his compatriots about all of the really complicated mating behavior of codfish. And it does sort of sound like a nightclub scene where cod have very different behavior while in this aggregation during the day and at night. And so during the daytime, it's kind of like when you get to the nightclub and the females, the girls, are dancing on the dance floor and all the guys are sort of standing around on the sidelines, drinking beer and hanging out. And, and then when the lights go out, or for the codfish, when the sun goes down, their behavior changes. And you could imagine you sort of cue the Barry White at this time and the single scene is on. And, and that's when the mingling is taking place. It's very similar to that. The other thing that's interesting is there's some indications that fishing activity can disrupt these spawning aggregations. So you imagine, back to your nightclub analogy, that's sort of like if the cops show up and the lights go on, everybody leaves. And that's really one of the things that we're interested in this project is, trying to understand exactly where that small, fine-scale aggregation is, so that we could protect that from that interaction with fishing gear. And that's the way that you can really protect the behavior of spawning, not necessarily the fish. Those fish might get caught by a fisherman at some other time, and that's okay. That's how our management system works. But what we're trying to do is protect that specific behavior. And I think another thing that Micah mentioned that's important is that, one of the reasons why we don't know exactly where these fish have been spawning is because we hadn't really cared that much before. When you have a robust population of fish, you're not going to try and protect a small spawning aggregation anyway. So now this is becoming a management tool that seems like it's really useful, particularly when you're in a crisis.
When you say a relatively small area, are these spawning aggregations something that could happen in, say, the area of a nightclub, or is it the area of a city? I mean, how large an area, or do we even know?
It depends on what you call the aggregation. That seems like an evasive answer, but as the nightclub scenario that Chris described, that there's this, the focal point, the epicenter of the aggregation is this female-dominated space, and that can be 50 meters across, and it's invariant across years, at least in the 4 or 5 years that we've been observing one with high-resolution telemetry. But orbiting that is this larger area of males that are kind of, waiting for the lights to fall, and so that they can stake out individual territories and start grunting and doing behaviors to attract a female. And that larger arena may be more of a city-sized scenario. But it's these individual focal points that we're worried about disruption, and that we have some evidence of seeing an intensive fishery going in on top of one of those and then disrupting it and not having it return within that season.
So it's not like the cops break up the party and everybody comes back the next night to try again.
Right.
It's broken up and it's done for the year.
Right. Perhaps it reforms somewhere else, but the tank experiments with spawning cod in captivity have shown that there's these dominance hierarchies and there's these behaviors and pecking orders that it takes time to establish. And it once you disrupt that, it may reset the clock, and this sort of lead up to the behavioral scene has to happen again. Whereas biologically, they may have now missed their optimal window to spawn.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Micah Dean, Chris McGuire, and Sophie Van Paris about their research on when and where cod gather to spawn. And Micah, as you mentioned, when the cod are gathering like this, the males grunt. And we actually have a recording of what those cod grunts sound like. So let's listen to that. Sophie Van Paris, you, as you mentioned, study largely whale vocalizations. When we think about ocean animals making noise, we all go right to the singing humpback whales, to maybe, a seal barking or something like that. how common is it for fish to make noise like this?
Fish make an awful lot of noise. There's particularly there's certain species of fish that are vocal all the time. And when we were actually doing our research listening for whales, we were continuously hearing other sounds, which we can attribute to a variety of different fish.
So how do you do that? How do you take a sound that was heard by some microphone sitting underwater, basically in the dark, and you're listening to it back in your lab, and how do you figure out what made that noise?
So when we're listening in our lab, we actually have some software programs that also visualize it for us. So they turn what you can hear into a kind of like a picture, a visual picture. And we can look at these and know which species are producing those sounds, because whales make very different types of sounds than fish, and each different species of fish makes a very different type of sound as well. So you can actually just look and listen and immediately say, oh, there's a humpback whale, and oh, there's haddock, or there's a cod. We also record, you know, other things like vessel noise and everything that's really going on in the ocean. So it's a really rich type of data that you can collect. There's a lot of information in it, which is also why, although we primarily focus on marine mammals and understanding where they are and when they're around, is that when we looked at all this fish information that we had, that we started to work with Micah and Chris and actually, you know, try to use it for something that would be, you know, of conservation value.
Could you use these grunting cod, just the noises they make themselves, to try to track them and figure out where and when these spawning aggregations are taking place?
I think the biggest thing we can do with the actual sounds is to get really good understanding of seasonal presence. So it's this, we can put out our recorders in the ocean for years on end. And so it gives you a really good timestamp as to when cod would start to spawn, how long they're spawning for. And then if you distribute it enough throughout a certain area, you can figure out where it is that they're actually forming those spawning aggregations. And so that's really the strength of that we can add through the passive acoustics component.
Now, what you're actually doing in this project, more than focusing on just listening to the cod grunts themselves, is you're listening for these radio tags that you're putting into the cod bellies. I mean, does that basically just come back on your recordings from underwater as ping, ping, ping? Can you distinguish individual fish? What kind of data do you get back when you've got these transmitters going?
We don't actually get the pings back from the transmitters. Micah and his colleagues put out separate acoustic telemetry receivers to listen for those. So we have kind of like two double series of acoustic receivers that are out there. Some listening for the sounds that are being made by the cod, and others listening for the pings.
And so with those radio tags, are you getting any data in real time, or is this something that you've got to, you know, wait and go back out and retrieve those receivers to find out what's going on?
Yeah, it's collecting. So the tags are pinging at random intervals on average every 90 seconds or so. And they're sending a unique identifier. So we have the information about that fish when we released it, how long it was, what sort of spawning condition it was in. And then we have the location of the receiver. That's the typical scenario. Oftentimes we'll also put sensors on those tags. We'll give us the depth that fish was at. You can also get temperature ones, but specifically it's mostly the location about that particular fish.
Now, the grad student that I watched putting these tags in, I was in awe of, first of all, his skill, and second of all, his stamina. I mean, it really was. It's maybe not as cold as today, but this was early December. It was cold. It was wet. And he's out there on the deck of this fishing boat with 2 or 3 inches of water sloshing around, you know, all of us in our foul weather gear and our boots. And he's essentially performing surgeries.
He is.
On these cod, flip them over on their backs, little incision, put in the radio tag, stitch it back up, you know, give it a few minutes to recover and back over the side. But we were at it for, I don't know, must have been 8 hours. And he tagged probably several dozen cod the day we were out there. How many of these fish are you tagging? How many do you need to actually get good information about a whole population?
Doug is a steady hand. He's done this.
He was amazing.
It is a, you know, in typical what they call mark and recapture experiments, where you put a tag of fish with some sort of unique identifier, you let it go, and then you just hope that somebody catches it and returns it to you. You don't have to have the massive numbers in this type of mark and recapture, because you're relying on your receivers, out there, these hydrophones, to listen for these acoustic pings from your tags. So we have pretty good ability to detect the fish once we release them. That's all about how you design your array of receivers to make sure that you're in the right place. But a lot of that comes from having some prior knowledge from communicating with the fishermen about positioning your receivers in the general location where we think spawning is going to occur, so that we can uncover the more fine details about the seasonality and the specific locations of the behaviors of the spawning.
Now, Chris, while we were out there, go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, so this is a three-year program, and just as far as the numbers, we put out about 150 tags in fish last season, and the season is sort of, you know, October, November till January. That's the winter cod spawning season, or at least we think so. That's one of the, you know, that's the general right. ballpark. And then we put out another 150 tags this year. So some of those fish are recaptured by the fishery. Some of them die of natural causes. Some of them probably die because of the surgeries. But so we have, you know, it's hard to say how many are active out there. But an interesting thing about those tags is they also, the battery life lasts for about 6 years. And so that even though our project only has one more year of active work, some of those fish are going to be swimming around with those tags that are actively transmitting for quite a while.
And will you be listening for them?
Well, right now we don't have funding to listen for them after next season, but there are lots of other people who are listening for other fish species, or cod or sturgeon or whatever, and they use similar receivers, and there are pretty good databases out there. So if I'm studying, you know, on our project, if we had a fish that we didn't tag show up in our array, Micah would be able to reach out to the scientists who did tag that fish and let them know that we got a stranger in our array. And that happens, I think, with some regularity.
It does, yeah.
And vice versa, you guys might be able to, beyond next year, piggyback on other projects to still be learning about the cod.
Exactly.
How much information do you think you'll get out of a, you know, 2-3 year project? Is it enough to say, yeah, we've got it, we've nailed it, we know where these populations of cod are going to spawn? Or is this just the first step to perhaps a series of studies to try to probe this question?
Well, it's pretty rare in fishery science to get to the place where you say we've nailed it. But
I think that's probably pretty rare in all of science.
But we think that in absence of information prior to this, we're going to provide quite a bit to go on, hopefully, for managers to use. You know, this particular area has been open and accessible to the fishery for quite a long time during the spawning season. And in the state that the stock is in now, this is where the concern is, that we'd want to prevent the loss of this spawning group, like the loss of so many of other spawning groups in the Gulf of Maine and elsewhere. So we hope that this will delineate some boundaries of where the bulk of the spawning occurs and provide some shelter, some space for them to do their business.
That's Micah Dean from the Massachusetts Department of Marine Fisheries. Also with me today, Sophie Van Paris from the Northeast Fisheries Science Center, and Chris McGuire from the Nature Conservancy. I'm Heather Goldstone. Living Lab continues after a short break. Stay with us. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. If you want to protect fish populations and yet still allow fishermen to catch them, it's critical to know when and where they go to reproduce. Micah Dean heads up cod spawning research for the Massachusetts Department of Marine Fisheries. Sophie Van Paris leads the Passive Acoustics Group at the Northeast Fisheries Science Center. And Chris McGuire is Marine Programs Director for the Nature Conservancy. Together, they're part of a sizable team trying to get a better handle on the timing and location of cod spawning. Now, Micah Dean, I still can't really wrap my head around how little we know. Is this just the case in this part of New England, or, you know, do we know even less perhaps about spawning aggregations around the rest of New England, and this area is perhaps leading the way?
Well, unfortunately, I don't think there's that many spawning aggregations of cod to know about. There used to be abundant cod spawning groups all along the coast of the Gulf of Maine from Canada down through Cape Cod, but the majority of those, in fact, almost the entire coastline of Maine, is now devoid of spawning fish. So really what we have left is the few groups that we know of that spawn in Massachusetts Bay and in Ipswich Bay. So we're trying, it's just by default, we're knowing more about these few groups because that's what we have available to us. But in the larger range of cod, most of what we know about the the finer scale behavior of spawning locations and timing, there's been a lot of captive experiments, tank studies, and where we can – we've learned a lot. But really, I think we're breaking some ground here in understanding what's going on in situ in the wild.
How much is climate change already changing or expected to change specifically cod spawning, perhaps the locations or the timing? If this is, you know, a genetic program that you come back to a particular clump of rocks and that's where you go to spawn, but suddenly it's 2, 3, 4, 5 degrees warmer, maybe too warm even for the young fish. Are the fish expected to be able to shift that, maybe go farther north or pick new locations? Or do we just see the disappearance of these particular spawning groups?
It's hard to tease out the climate change aspect. I mean, anyone who's engaged with that topic will always say that you need so many years of observation to be able to really point to an effect there. But I think that there is evidence that environment can affect these traditional sites. I mean, the amount of fidelity to specific spawning locations is just remarkable. We've seen female individual cod will tag in 1 year, and as Chris mentioned, these tags will last for 6 years. We'll have the same fish come back to the same exact rock pile within 8 meters or so every year for as long as we've been able to observe.
I mean, it's
them.
Like the sea turtles that come back to the exact same beach
right.
year after year after year.
And I'm not sure that it's a genetic or chemical imprinting. My suspicion is that there may be a social learning aspect to this too. That this is passed down from the older generations that have this evolutionary knowledge to spawn this location, and that there's the younger spawners will follow these larger, older fish to these locations. And this is also part of the danger of if you overexploit a population so that you lose the older individuals. We call it age structure truncation. That you may lose that information, and now you have more variable spawning with less positive outcomes.
Well, so at least the hope there that maybe these cod populations can adapt their behavior. You're saying losing that population knowledge, and I immediately thought of, I believe it's whooping cranes, where they've actually had to go with like ultralight airplanes
right.
and try to lead them because they've lost that institutional or societal kind of
right.
knowledge of where to go. But maybe we'll be out there leading cod to new piles of rocks in the future. Now, as we've already mentioned, this project is a cooperative research project, meaning that fishermen are directly involved. In this case, actually kind of came up with the question itself. Chris McGuire, when you're engaged in a cooperative research project like this, how much of the motivation to really work with fishermen is to do better science, because they have information or tools that perhaps the scientific community doesn't have? And how much of the motivation is essentially trying to build trusting relationships or even repair a rift between scientists and fishermen? How do you balance those two out, or which one ranks, if either?
Yeah, I think that I think all of those things are important. The reason why the Conservancy as an approach works with commercial fishermen, well, with fishermen in general, is, basically they have the most to gain from turning things around, and they are the most dependent on a healthy ecosystem, right? So they seem like natural partners. And as you said, there is certain knowledge that fishermen have. In many cases, they know more about where something is happening than anyone else. And there is the opportunity to gain the trust of the people that you're working with, but I wouldn't say that that's like the single largest motivation. Really, one of the things that the Conservancy is trying to do is to really put fishermen back into a role of really taking ownership for how these fisheries are managed. We call it co-management, and trying to help them, be better stewards of the resource and feel like it's their responsibility for themselves and for their communities to become more actively involved in the conservation and management of their fisheries. So, I mean, that's really the reason why we bring them into a project. And that's how come I was sitting at the kitchen table with Frank and some of the other fishermen when we started talking about this project.
Now, we already heard from Frank Mirarchi. He has a kind of a partner on the Barbara K. Peters. And actually, I'm sorry, I've forgotten Kevin's last name.
Norton, yeah.
Kevin Norton. And Kevin's a young guy in his 40s. He has a young family. And if Frank is the poster child for cooperative research, Kevin's not entirely sold on him. I mean, at one point I had a conversation with him where he just said, you know, I've got to be honest with you. This doesn't excite me. I want to put fish on people's plates. I want to be catching food and feeling like I'm producing something, and pulling cod in to stick tags in their bellies and throw them back overboard just doesn't do it for me. And at one point while we were out on the boat, I kind of pulled him aside and really pushed him on where he stood on the whole research endeavor and whether he really thought that this was worthwhile.
This project is definitely a good idea, but for one thing, I've been saying from the beginning, I believe that the larger aggregation of fish is earlier in the year, October, November. In both years now, we've missed that by starting late.
But won't you be able to see that with the telemetry next year?
If the fish are coming back. I mean, yeah, if it all works. I mean, we only had a few fish come back this year. I agree 100% that I don't think any fisherman would want to be in here catching spawning fish. But there is a fine line between making a living and allowing fish to spawn. I mean, I think what they did here in the beginning of sectors and just leaving it wide open and letting guys stay here. And there were big boats here. And we all were, even the smaller boats. We were working on these fish hard because they had us on a hard tack for the year, and it didn't work. But it's a management thing that they need to change. You know, this is something that we're doing to try to get some information. Now we were only, 75 tags into this last year, and very hardly any information from it, and they decided that this whole area was a spawning ground, and they shut it all down. I mean, they had absolutely... I mean, we know it, but there's no scientific knowledge to prove it. We're working on that. It was going to be a three-year project.
I guess what you were saying earlier to me sounded like you didn't necessarily think it was worth doing the research. And coming from my background, I don't know, I don't see how more information could be a bad thing. Well, it's how you act on the information.
Right, but you got to understand, every time there's any bit of information, it gets used against us. There's never any of these joint things that work in the fisherman's favor, and we end up with, you know, being able to fish an extra month or more fish, or... Every time this happens, we get cut. And now we're down to, this year we got our codfish cut by 78%. Now they also are taking away 6 months a year. So they have to understand that there has to be, people have to work too. You can't just shut everything down.
That's Kevin Norton. And, you know, keep in mind, this is a guy who's under tremendous stress, right? This is supposed to be December, supposed to be his kind of boom part of the season to be catching fish, and you know, he was expressing to me, like, how am I going to put Christmas presents under the tree for my kids in a few weeks, and, you know, these really pressing concerns. So you can understand the anxiety and where some of that mistrust comes from, but Chris McGuire, that's got to be a little discouraging. I mean, does he express those misgivings to you, and how does that make you feel about the whole endeavor?
Yeah, it's a little, I mean, it's definitely a little discouraging to hear that. But like you said, I mean, these fishermen are under tremendous stress. And, you know, I think the hard part about all of these research projects is, you know, research teams, our role is to bring information that does not presently exist into the management arena. And management is a pretty ugly political process where a compromise solution is brokered. And there are a lot of players in the management process. And so to some extent, you know, we have to do the best that we can to generate the information that we're looking for. And then, you know, the managers are going to make the decisions that they make based on whatever information that they have. And what we're hoping for in this project is to bring more information that would allow them to make better decisions, which we hope would lead toward more fishing opportunity for fishermen going forward. And, you know, we had, as soon as the closures went into effect, we really struggled to maintain the participation of fishermen like Kevin. And we talked with a lot of fishermen around the region and basically said, you know, if we don't continue this project, I don't see how you ever get to a different solution than where we are now. So in the absence of new information, how do you end up with fewer areas closed? So, I mean, that's really, and I think that's the reason why we've continued that project is, and it's a hard reality, but that's sort of where we're at. But I mean, this is a really tough situation.
Micah Dean, full disclaimer, none of you are the ones making the regulations and making the decisions, but you do work with the New England Fishery Management Council, also the Atlantic States Fishery Management Commission. Do you, in your mind, have, an ideal outcome of doing this research and how it would be acted on in a management setting?
Well, yeah, I think in an ideal world, the timelines of things would align, but as you can see, Kevin's frustration, it didn't align, and it often doesn't. To get good science with an answer that you can really use takes time. And this is a 3-year project, which we were halfway through now. And when the discussions about what areas to close to protect spawning cod came up last year, we were only partially started in this project. And so that was spawned because of the outcome of the recent stock assessment, which said the stock was in such terrible shape. So there was a management imperative to do something. And so they had to rely on the coarse information that they had at the time, which ended up closing large areas. And so ideally, we would have preferred to see the outcome of this project be plugged directly into the management decision-making and say, in this area, here are the areas where you really need to protect, and there may be other areas that that wouldn't do harm to fish for other species for which fishermen have allocations for. But that's just not how it turns out. All we know is that to proceed with our research projects and knowing that the information that we provide will hopefully be incorporated into the management decisions in the future.
And I could say there is some precedent for this. The council, Micah and others, helped generate this information for a spawning area that is north of Cape Ann that we call Whaleback. And it's a relatively small spawning area that was generated out of good research. And, that information was used around these closures in order to basically allow greater access because they knew a lot more about what was going on in that area. So, I think that there is, an opportunity for management to use this data in the way that the fishermen hope that they will.
I know one possibility that has been raised, and we've got just about a minute left. So briefly, could the kind of information that you're getting, could you envision a scenario in which there are, microphones out there listening and you start to hear the cod grunting and you say, oh, they've come. We're going to close down for a little while. And when the grunting stops, we'll open it back up. So-called dynamic closures. Is that a realistic scenario, at least in the near future?
I wouldn't say in the near future, and I think it's more realistic to be able to describe in general what occurs and then design a management system around that. I think you'll be more reliable and more effective if we can achieve something like that.
That's Micah Dean of the Massachusetts Department of Marine Fisheries, also Chris McGuire, Marine Programs Director for the Nature Conservancy, and Sophie Van Paris, who leads the Passive Acoustics Group at the Northeast Fisheries Science Center. Thank you all.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Until next week, this is Living Lab. You can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.